Hello and welcome to episode 9 of Space Talks, a half-hour science-based show with a particular interest in all things space. This is Stephen Lowry along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim. I know you've got something of an update or foreshadow today. Before we begin on today's topic, what do you have in mind?
It's pretty exciting news, Steve. NASA announced that they'd done some of the evaluation of the material that had been brought back from the Japanese spacecraft that had visited the asteroid Ryugu, which is about a 1 kilometer wide near-Earth or asteroid. Back in 2019, the spacecraft did some excavating, brought back some samples, which were quote-unquote dropped off to planet Earth in the year 2020. I know this all sounds quite fabulous, but even more so was the result of the findings. These samples had something called uracil and also vitamin B3. Uracil is an RNA compound, and vitamin B3 is also a requisite for life as we know it. And these were both found on the asteroid, which gives us a little taste of a show or an episode that we certainly have to get to, because this is remarkable evidence of how life may have landed here on planet Earth.
And my little bit of an update is with regard to an earlier episode's mention of the world's first 3D printed rocket, Terran 1, lifted off from the Cape Canaveral Space Force Station. And the mission was nicknamed Good Luck, Have Fun. Terran 1 did not carry a client satellite, as will be the case in the future rocket launches. It was a nighttime launch. It went letter perfect and the entire first stage burned. But the second stage rocket ignited only briefly, and subsequently the payload lacked sufficient speed to enter orbit. And though a failure in some aspects, the viability of 3D rocket printing was proven.
Today, however, I think we're going to talk about the stars, but not in the fashion that we usually have in the past. In fact, you might say this episode was written in the stars.
So we're not going to be talking about how stars formed or how they have brilliantly spectacular deaths, but something else instead. Is that right?
That's indeed right. We're simply going to accept that the stars are, so to speak, in the sky, and their pinpoints of brightness have been illuminating the human imagination for a very long time. We're going to be talking about constellations.
Well, I'm glad that you used the word pinpoint to describe what stars look like to the unaided eye. You know, when I first became interested in astronomy, I couldn't wait to look at a bright star through a telescope. And what a disappointment that proved to be, because even though the magnification on the lens said 450 power, the star was still a mere pinpoint. And I came to learn that even with the best optically based land telescopes, that's about all you're ever going to see when looking at a star, a pinpoint. For the average person or astronomer, a good pair of binoculars is far superior to a telescope.
So that's been my experience too, Steve, with binoculars and telescopes. But today we're going to go back through time, as we often have done in this series, in order to talk about constellations. It's helpful to take a longer-term view of how the world must have seemed to people a very long time ago, before TV and radio, and in fact, before even electricity. The first electrical power plants began in the 1880s, so we're talking way back before then.
When the sun went down, so did the vast majority of people. And you know, I did a little research about pre-industrial sleep patterns, and it turns out that our modern-day sleep habits were certainly not the norm back then. At that time, a person would have physically toiled hard during the day and gone to bed shortly after sundown for what was known as their first sleep. Then they would arise around midnight or 1 a.m, have something to eat, perhaps do some light chores, maybe write letters or manuscripts by candlelight, and then go back to bed for their second sleep.
People would naturally become more aware of the heavens above and how they appear to change over time.
And, you know, it wouldn't take an observer long to notice that the star patterns and the stars appear to move across the sky at night. And so, relatively speaking, you could judge what time it was.
We know that ditty, starlight, star bright, first star I see tonight. Well, in the pre-science ages, early humans must have wondered where those stars came from. We see them at night, but then they disappear during the day. Did the sun drive or frighten them away? Does the moon rise and beckon them to come out and play? These were some of the notions of the time. There's the history of sleep patterns and looking at the sky more frequently, but let's get to where that connects with the constellations we're going to be talking about today.
Well, as we talked about in previous episodes, our brains are hardwired to look for patterns. And as mentioned, since there's nothing else to do at the night but look at the stars, it wasn't long before people noticed that the stars appeared to make patterns in the sky, much in the same way that when we look at clouds in the daytime, we can discern shapes.
Well, I have to confess, I've always been something of a cynic when it comes to these connecting the dots and seeing things. Obviously, you know, find three stars, connect them, and what have you got, a triangle?
Indeed, there is a constellation called Triangulum, and I do admit that is perhaps the lamest of the constellations, and it can hold no candle to some others, such as the beautiful Corona Borealis.
But we have heard of the Big Dipper. Presume that's only how we know it on this part of the planet. It must go by other names elsewhere.
Well, it does, and that's where we delve into various cultures to examine their names for it. So in the British Isles, the Big Dipper is known as the Plough. In Germanic cultures, it's known as the Great Wagon. In the Netherlands, it's called the Saucepan. In Finland, it's known as the Salmon Net. In Greece and many other cultures, it's the Bear. In Burma, it's a crustacean or a prawn. And in ancient India, the Big Dipper is known as the Seven Wise Men.
Now, this talk of constellations reminds me of the Subaru car manufacturer. And of course, I drive one, in fact, have for a long time. If you look at the front grille of the car, you can see that there are six stars. And I've read that Subaru is the Japanese name for the Pleiades constellation, which is Greek for the Seven Sisters. I was a bit confused about that, Steve. The constellation has seven stars, but it's stylized with just six on the logo. But that's because it's really hard for most people to see all of those stars. Delving a little bit deeper, I found out that in Japanese, Subaru not only refers to that constellation, but also signifies the word unite. It was in 1953 that five Japanese car companies merged to form the Fuji Heavy Industries, which had to choose a new logo. And guess what? They used that constellation as a source, and the bright star would represent their new unified corporation.
Tim, you know, your reference to the Greek word Pleiades brings to mind that many constellations and their constituent stars aren't English. Now, to give an example, the seven brightest stars which make up Ursa Major, to which the Big Dipper belongs, will sound strange to ears. So, Tim, after I read them out, try to guess their cultural origin. So here we go. There's Dube, Mirak, Fecta, Megrez, Alioth, Mizar, and Alcade.
I'm going to go with Arabic because of the two stars, Mizar and Alcade. That sounds Arabic to me.
Well, you're right. And their English translated names are fascinating. Dube is Arabic for bear. Mirak translates as loins of the bear.
I can see where this is going.
Fecte means thigh of the bear, while Megrez translates as the base of the bear's tail.
You got the whole bear covered. Is that it?
Well, as Ron Paul Peel would say, but wait, there's more. And indeed there is, although Alioth means the sheep's fat tail.
I'm going to get confused here. Where did that come from?
I think then we have to stop and blame it on antiquity. And rounding out the constellation, there's the star Mizar, my favorite, which means apron. Another strange one, perhaps unless they're referring to a butcher's apron. And the last star is Alcade, which sounds an awful lot like the terrorist group Al-Qaeda.
Okay, so I'll bite. What does Al-Qaeda translate into English?
Well, it's a strange one, Tim, and it translates as, quote, the crying maidens of the beer. And here's the amazing twist to it all. A beer, spelled B-I-E-R and not B-E-E-R, is a portable stand for a coffin. And in Arabian culture, the three stars at the handle of the Big Dipper are the three mourning daughters, while the four stars of the Dipper form the coffin's bier.
In the UK and Canada, historically, the seven bright stars form a big ladle or dipper, but in Arabic-speaking cultures, they saw the very same stars and imagined a funeral?
Well, that's right. And all this talk about stars reminds me of two of Vincent van Gogh's paintings done while living in the south of France. While in Arles in 1888, he painted the famous Café Terrasse at night, which features figures of people drinking under a dark blue sky studded with stars. And a year later, he painted his perhaps more famous Starry Night, which certainly inspired Don McLean of American Pie fame to compose a song about it. And as a treat, here's a snippet of that 1972 song, Starry, Starry Night.
Starry, starry night, paint your palette blue and gray. Look out on a summer's day with eyes that know the darkness in my soul.
All right, Steve, you mentioned earlier that star Mazar was your favorite star in the Big Dipper. Now, you're the only friend I have who has a favorite star. Can you explain what that's about?
Well, my formative years were spent living at an Air Force base just south of Portage la Prairie, and you can well imagine the clarity of stars on a cold Manitoba winter night. One evening, my dad pointed out the Big Dipper to me and then pointed out Mizar, the middle star in the handle, and he told me to look closely and tell him what I could see. Well, I squinted and peered and saw nothing but the star, and that's when he knew for sure I needed glasses, because Mizar is actually a binary star. And so people with normal vision can see that there's a fainter companion star beside it called Alcor, and it's Arabic for the fainter one. And after failing to see the second star, Dad mentioned that the First Nations people used to use that star combination as a visual acuity test. And these two stars in their culture were called the horse and saddle. And interestingly, when I did get glasses, I still had some difficulty resolving Alcor when looking at Mizar, until I learned a visual trick to overcome an inherent problem which all people have when looking at distant faint objects.
Previously, Steve, we've talked about the human eye's blind spots and how the brain can compensate for this by cutting and pasting adjacent colors, patterns, and filling them in. And now you're talking about another kind of human eye deficiency, correct?
Well, that's right. The eye has two types of detectors within the retina called rods and cones. The cones are color receptors and the rods are the low light detectors. Well, as it turns out, the central part of the retina is packed with color receptors and not a whole bunch of light gathering receptors. So if you want to see a faint object, you have to slightly avert your vision so more starlight falls upon the eye's rods, which are slightly off-center inside our eyes.
So looking at that star, Mizar, it's the brightest star in the handle of the Big Dipper. You slightly shift your gaze to one side, and then the other star, Alcor, will magically appear, correct?
And there you have it. And when you see that happen, you'll be absolutely amazed.
All right. Well, I can't wait to see another clear night, not often in these parts. Now, doing some research about constellations, that's what we're talking about today. I found that there are some 88 of them grouped into three categories. There are the circumpolar constellations, zodiacal constellations, or zodiacal, you can say it either way, and seasonal constellations. First group, circumpolar constellations, are those that you can always see throughout the year as they never dip below the horizon, regardless of the season. For those of us in Canada, there are five of them, namely Ursa Major, Ursa Minor, Draco, Cassiopeia, and Cepheus. Now, because they revolve around the pole, the North Star, people living south of the equator can't see them. Incidentally, the North Star has the proper name of Polaris, and it's found at the end of Ursa Major, better known to most as Little Dipper. Merely by chance, you can find Polaris by drawing and extending an imaginary line from the two brightest stars in the Big Dipper, and it points to Polaris, the North Star. Now, of course, those living south of the equator can't see our circumpolar constellations, and we can't see theirs. Down south, they've got Carina, Centaurus, and Crux. Carina is Latin for keel, as in the keel of a ship, and it contains the bright star Canopus, which is the second brightest star in the sky. It's a pity that we can't see that here in Canada, although we do get to see the brightest star, Sirius, which is in the constellation Canis Major, the big dog.
And you know, Tim, last night I was out and I did see it. It was such a treat to see. And doing a little research about the word Sirius, I found that it's aptly derived from the Greek word Sirios, meaning glowing or scorching.
Well, there is also Crux, which, although it's the smallest of the 88 constellations, it contains the very visible asterism or star pattern called the Southern Cross, which assisted Magellan and other sailors in navigating as the pole star disappears as they cross the equator. And it's important to sort of underscore the importance of constellations and stargazing as a way of navigation.
The zodiacal constellations are the second group, Tim, and they consist of the 12 constellations which the sun appears to pass through during the course of 1 year. And interestingly, the word zodiac is Greek for circle of little animals. And as I rhyme off the constellations, I'm sure that those of us listening out there would know some of them. Here we go. Aquarius, Pisces, Aries, Taurus, Gemini, Cancer, Leo, Virgo, Libra, Scorpius, Sagittarius, and Capricorn. Some of those are animals.
Well, you might say it's a circus of animals then, because Pisces is, of course, the fish, Aries is the ram, Taurus the bull, Leo is the lion, Scorpius is the scorpion, and Capricorn is the goat.
And finally, we have the seasonal constellations, which we see in the winter, but they go away in the summer. And for us in Canada, they are Cancer the crab, Gemini the twins, Auriga the charioteer, Perseus the king, Canis Major the big dog, Taurus the bull, Orion the hunter, and Monoceros the unicorn.
We can't talk about constellations without talking about astrology, and the zodiacal constellations are obviously intimately associated with that. And it deals with forecasting earthly and human events through the interpretation of the stars and the motions of the sun, the moon, and planets. Back in antiquity, astrology and astronomy were one and the same, and it wasn't until the late 1600s that emerging scientific facts, such as the heliocentric solar system, undermined the theoretical basis of astrology, causing it to lose its academic standing and relegating it to that of a pseudoscience.
So nowadays, a lot of people like astrology and they view it as a form of entertainment. But for those that take it seriously, unfortunately, there's a rude awakening in the fact that a university experiment was concluded in which the professor handed each student a sealed envelope containing purportedly their personal astrological predictions for the coming week. And when the class resumed, the students universally stated that those predictions were extremely accurate. And it was only then that the professor announced that each and every one had been given identical predictions. Now, this is called the Barnum-Forer effect, and it's a specific example of the so-called, quote, acceptance phenomenon, which describes the tendency of people to accept almost any old bogus personality feedback as long as it tends to be about them and it's positive.
Let's agree that there's some dubious merit to astrology, but I'm going to try to give it some love today. At its root, astrology was about people looking at the sky and finding hidden truths and telling stories and then sharing them with other people. And if you think about the amount of space that's been taken up in mainstream newspapers each day, giving people their daily horoscope, there must have been a pretty substantial audience to justify that use of space. And I think we can all remember, or most of us can, the question, what sign are you? Now, Steve, don't answer that. I don't want to know. But us boomers, and most every generation since, are familiar with the music from the play Hair. It hit the stage in 1967, and the play has been a long-running success for, well, more than half a century, and it's still finding new audiences and new interpretations. Also quick to jump on the astrology bandwagon was Diana Ross and the Supremes with their song, quote, no matter what sign you are, which references the supposed fact that certain zodiacal signs and people are better suited for each other and one another. For instance, an Aries is said to be compatible with a Sagittarius, but should never date a Scorpio. Getting back to constellation names, we've mentioned that there are many that are named for animals, but another large subset denotes people, with the majority concerning the Perseus myth of Greek folklore.
And first, we should note here that this is rather a chicken and egg question. Cultural myths and stories preceding the names of the constellations. So pre-literate societies would pass along stories of their heroes and villains, and the elders would use the stars as a sort of celestial storybook to add awe and wonderment to their tales. So tell us, Tim, what is the Perseus myth and its associated constellations?
Well, I thought you'd never ask, Steve. In Greek mythology, Perseus is the greatest hero and slayer of monsters. And so a constellation was created in his honor, along with seven other constellations, such as Andromeda, Cassiopeia, and Pegasus.
To round out the grouping of constellations, there's another set named after objects, namely Fornax, the furnace, Calum, the chisel, Antilla, the air pump, Prologium, the clock, Microscopium, the microscope, and no points for guessing this one, Telescopium. And briefly staying with names, within a constellation's, its stars are ranked in order of brightness using the Greek alphabet, starting with alpha, beta, gamma, and delta. That corresponds to our ABCD. And using Orion the Hunter as an example, its four brightest stars are called Alpha Orionis, Beta Orionis, Gamma Orionis, and Delta Orionis.
So one of the advantages of knowing these constellations is that we can use them to locate some of the stars we're interested in. And let's continue the Orion example. Alpha Orionis is Betelgeuse, a massive red supergiant star on the verge of exploding as a supernova. Beta Orionis is Rigel, very hot blue-colored supergiant, also likely to end its life in a supernova explosion. Gamma Orionis is Bellatrix, the female warrior, a blue giant too small to go supernova. And lastly, Delta Orionis is Mintaka, another hot-burning blue giant.
And you know, Tim, your brief description of Bellatrix as being a female star reminds me of the science-related quote about a lovely woman which goes, "She wasn't a constellation, she was a whole galaxy."
Well, I'm not going to be outdone here. Here's another one. Now, the nights are full of bright shining stars whispering your name into a constellation. And for you young listeners out there, I know you're there. You might be well advised to remember that one.
Well, Tim, with modern science stripping away the aura of stellar mythology, I think it worthwhile to remember our elders of old recounting bedtime stories to their children and instilling the following sentiment, quote, "I have loved the stars too fondly to be fearful of the night."
It's a lovely thought. Well, we're just about out of time today, Steve, but I think we really have to make a note here for folks that if you're interested in learning more about constellations, there's an app for that. In fact, there's all kinds of apps that are freely available. Some you can pay a premium for, and I find them very helpful. You can point your screen at the sky at night, and it will tell you what you're looking at, what you're seeing, what might be there, and that includes the stars, the moons, planets. Even sometimes they'll show you where there's satellites coming into focus. And it's a really helpful thing, and it's free. So I'd give that a suggestion.
Well, Tim, you know, I use Night Sky for constellations and planets. And I also like using ISS Spotter for locating the space station and Aurora Now for updates on the Aurora Borealis.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode as much as we did in researching it. And we look forward to seeing you next time when our topic is going to be a discussion about science fiction quotes. So this is Tim Woods
and Stephen Lowry ending this episode, not in its usual fashion, but with some ambient celestial music. We invite you to sit back, relax, close your eyes, and imagine looking at some of those stars and constellations mentioned today, and let your imagination and cares drift away. Goodbye until next episode.